Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. On today's show, we'll hear excerpts about current events in 2009 in Chicago, one involving a presentation about torture in Guantanamo and in Chicago, and another about a brief interview of a dramatic protest in downtown Chicago. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a selection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
This week, Media Minutes looks at five of the top stories of 2008. The fight for a free and open internet took a big step forward at the FCC in August. In a landmark decision that was called a bellwether case for the future of the internet, a bipartisan majority at the agency forced Comcast to stop blocking and publicly disclose its method for interfering with lawful internet traffic. Comcast blocked legal peer-to-peer content by sending fake signals that cut off the connection between file sharers. The FCC vote followed a months-long investigation launched in response to a legal complaint filed by Free Press and Public Knowledge. The FCC held a series of hearings on Comcast's blocking, including one at Harvard University, where the company was caught paying people to fill up seats and crowd out the public. The August decisions was the first time the agency had taken action to protect users' rights to access the internet content of their choice.
Throughout 2008, the FCC turned out some major decisions for wireless broadband and the internet. As the year began, speculation about the auction of a prime slice of the public airwaves, called the 700 megahertz spectrum, reached a fevered pitch. Public interest groups were cheered when the FCC issued requirements that a portion of the prized spectrum must be open to any phone or device. But their celebration was short-lived when Verizon won the auction in March with a $9.4 billion bid. AT&T was the other big winner in the auction. By allowing the dominant phone companies to gain an even bigger wireless footprint, the FCC wiped out a chance to create meaningful competition for wireless broadband. Prospects brightened in November, however. Bucking pressure from broadcasters, the wireless phone industry, and wireless microphone companies, the FCC cleared the way for new technology to use empty TV channels known as white spaces to connect millions to the internet. New devices using what's been called Wi-Fi on steroids could be on the market in the next 18 months.
In April, the New York Times uncovered a shocking scheme in which the Pentagon spread favorable views of the Iraq War by recruiting and planting military analysts in the nation's news media. While these ex-military officers were being coached by the Pentagon and simultaneously consulting for military contractors, they appeared as allegedly independent military analysts on every major cable and broadcast network. Not only did the networks fail to disclose their conflicts, but after the Times expose appeared, they failed to cover that story and continued to employ many of the same analysts. Still, more than 100,000 letters were sent to Congress demanding an investigation, and the House voted in May to outlaw the Defense Department from spreading propaganda to the American public. That news didn't get covered by the major networks either.
Dozens of journalists from independent and mainstream publications, including Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! And a photographer from the Associated Press, were arrested trying to cover protests outside the 2008 Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, in September. Journalists were roughed up by police officers, detained anywhere from several hours to several days, and had their equipment and film confiscated. Though largely ignored in the round-the-clock convention coverage, thousands of people still deluge city officials with calls and emails demanding the journalists be released. After activists converged on City Hall to deliver more than 50,000 petitions, the journalists were let go and all charges were dropped. However, calls for an investigation into preemptive raids before the convention and the targeting of the media have gone unheeded.
In 2008, grassroots media activists across the country hit the ground running to educate and organize for changes to our media system. Grassroots activists are sharing winning strategies and connecting media issues to social justice through innovative projects like New York's People's Production House and partnerships like Magnet, the Media Action Grassroots Network. After the FCC passed rules gutting media ownership limits in the waning days of 2007, media reformers turned up the heat on Congress, prompting a Senate vote to overturn the FCC's actions. Public access television producers got organized and brought their concerns to Washington, catching the attention of Congress, and in states like Illinois, where the Attorney General is investigating the mistreatment of community television channels by AT&T. Community radio advocates built new stations from the ground up, and collected more than 100 co-sponsors in Congress to support the Local Community Radio Act, a bill that would create thousands of new low-power FM radio stations. This legislation, promoted by the tireless advocates at the Prometheus Radio Project, could finally become law in 2009.
To hear these stories and many more from 2008, go to the Media Minutes archives at freepress.net/media-minutes.
The National Bureau of Economic Research has announced that, by its calculations, the United States has been in a recession for almost a year, beginning in December of 2007. This stands in stark contrast to the pronouncements from the most widely quoted corporate economists and the Bush administration, who hesitated to call the unfolding collapse a recession until it could not be denied, making themselves look either incompetent or dishonest. In fact, they are both. The economists most cited in corporate media are shills and boosters for capitalism in general and for Wall Street in particular. They function as highly paid mercenaries for finance capital and are legitimized by a corporate media that all but abolished labor reporting decades ago. The corporate worldview is transmitted to the public at large without refutation from left economists. As a result, the corporate mouthpieces who call themselves economists are unchallenged as they spread disinformation and wishful thinking rather than fact-based analysis. The root of the problem is deeper than the corporate economists' personal dishonesty, venality, and greed, traits they share with their bosses on Wall Street. Lying is an essential element of their job description, which is to make corporate rule appear both benign and inevitable. Their prime imperative is to maintain confidence in the markets among existing and potential stockholders, the better to fleece them and to transform the global economy into a con man's paradise. Confidence is everything when you're running a confidence game. These corrupt corporate economists' core function is to disseminate propaganda packaged as objective truth, lest the finance capital money-sucking machine grind to a halt, which has now come to pass. Even as the impending meltdown of finance capital's Ponzi schemes and trillions in fictitious money became obvious to any objective observer, these corporate economists continued to maintain, like George Bush, that the economy's fundamentals were sound. To say differently would be to betray their corporate masters and the prime imperative to keep the bubbles afloat. And even now, with the planetary economy in freefall, corporate economists continue to insist that the crisis in public confidence is irrational. The alternative would be to confess that finance capital has soiled everyone's nest, and that corporate economists had colluded with corporate criminals to inflate bubbles that were unsustainable and inevitably lethal to the entire system. When the market meltdown hit and the lords of capital demanded they be allowed to drain the national wealth and future, economists that had always railed against government intervention reversed themselves overnight. Their purpose became to indoctrinate the public on why life itself depended on transferring trillions of dollars in the people's money to the perpetrators of monstrous crimes. Corporate economists are co-conspirators in the ongoing larceny. They devise economic theories to facilitate their Wall Street masters' crimes. Don't believe a word they say. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature two excerpts of segments about current events in Chicago in 2009. In this first excerpt, we'll hear from civil rights attorney Flint Taylor, who spoke about torture in Guantanamo and in Chicago as part of Camp Hope, a 19-day-long peace and justice vigil near the home of President Barack Obama. The following presentation was recorded on Sunday, January 11, 2009.
We come here knowing that President-elect Obama brings us much hope, but we also know that he comes from a city that is the torture capital of the United States, if you exclude Guantanamo as being part of the United States. And we know that he was silent during that period of time. And we know what he said today about Guantanamo. And we also know that the most asked question on his website is, are you going to prosecute the war criminals who led this country and who are responsible for torture in Guantanamo, at Abu Ghraib, in those unknown sites of rendition? Now, we know about prosecuting torturers here in the city of Chicago. We know that our mayor should have prosecuted John Burge and his torturers 25 or 30 years ago. We knew that it took, or we know now, that it took 30 years to get one indictment. But we know that we got that indictment. And we know there are many more indictments that need to be gotten of other torturers who worked at the hand of John Burge here in the city of Chicago. And we know that there's a lot more to accomplish before justice is done here. It's the same internationally. On that website, they refuse to answer the question, will you prosecute? Will you investigate Cheney and Bush and those who authorized, who said it was okay to torture, who said it was okay to waterboard, who said it was okay to do the things that happened in these horrible places that we all now know about? They refused to answer that. They said only, referred back to Biden's statement many months ago, in which he said, when asked this question, a bit of double talk, and ultimately said, we want to look forward, not backward. But when war crimes are committed, they must be prosecuted. You cannot have a society that does not deal with its past in that way. Any more than you could allow John Burge to go on any longer living in Florida, having a boat paid by the taxpayers' money, a known torturer in this city, without prosecution of John Burge. You cannot allow Bush and Cheney to travel this world as war criminals. And as was pointed out the other night on television by a distinguished constitutional law professor, that if this country and President Obama and this Congress do not deal with the war crimes committed at Guantanamo, with the war crimes and the torture that were committed at Abu Ghraib, with the war crimes and the torture that were committed at the secret rendition prisons, then some other country is going to do it. We are no different than Pinochet in Chile and the apartheid government in South Africa and other governments too numerous to mention where war crimes and torture and murder was committed in the name of government. And those countries had to deal with those problems. They had to, at first, recognize those crimes, and they had to prosecute those crimes. And if they didn't, in some instances, those criminals were indicted by the international courts and by courts in Germany and other places. So we, as people of conscience and people who want full justice and want this country to actually stand for its own constitution and be able to hold its head up when it talks about the democratic rights that it has and brags about what kind of a democratic society we live under, well, we must hold not only the John Burges of the world accountable, not only his underlings accountable, not only Richard Daley and Richard Devine and those in this city, but we must hold George Bush, Cheney, and all of those that the men who wrote those memos who said that this isn't torture. And this is how you get around all of these different laws on the books. This is how you say that it's not torture. Well, it is torture. Waterboarding is torture. Dry Submarino by John Burge in this city is the same as waterboarding. Just one is done in the water and one is done with a plastic bag. Putting electric shock on the genitals of men in Abu Ghraib is the same as putting electric shock on the genitals of Andrew Wilson and numerous other black men on the south side of the city of Chicago for a 20-year period by John Burge and Peter Dignan and John Byrne and many other known and branded torturers. So when we talk about this and when we seek justice, we have to see the linking. The linking here in Obama's home city for a 30-year pattern of torture and cover-up. The same kind of techniques that we see used in Abu Ghraib, and we see used in Guantanamo, and we saw used in Vietnam. Because the circle is complete here in the city of Chicago. Because John Burge got his training in Vietnam in 1969. And his henchman, Peter Dignan, got his training on a in Vietnam in the 60s. And we all know now what they did to civilians and to suspected what they called Viet Cong in those days. What the U.S. government and what they did on POW camps and prisons like where John Burge worked. We now know that they used the same electric shock devices that Burge used here in Chicago that he brought back here to Chicago. And we all know that the same kind of racism and inhumanity to fellow man fueled John Burge in the same way that it fueled the torture in Abu Ghraib and it fueled the torture and the murder in Vietnam. So we have to see Chicago in an international context, and we have to also see the international context in light of Chicago. Because another thing that we've learned is that when the soldiers came back from Vietnam, such as John Burge, they were ready to apply the racist and inhumane tactics that they learned and practiced there, here in our country. That Burge in 1972 became a detective with the Chicago Police Department. Within months, torture started with him and other detectives at Area 2. Electric shock, baggings, dry submarino, mock executions, the same kind of thing that happens and happened internationally. And we know that when the torture happened and was exposed in Abu Ghraib, at least some of those guards were former guards in the prisons of this country who had long records of abuse in those prisons. And we now know that men and women are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. So we have to be on guard again for another cycle of torture in this country. Racist, inhumane torture. Now, one of the things that was very important in moving the U.S. attorney here to indict John Burge after so many years was the fact that many of us went to international bodies and raised the issue of torture in the city of Chicago. We went first to the Inter-American Committee on Human Rights in Washington, and we had a hearing there. And then we went to the Committee Against Torture in Geneva. And we also went to the UN Committee Against Racism. And as a result, in early 2006, the Committee Against Torture of the United Nations issued a report. And in that report, it condemned the U.S. government for not prosecuting torture here in the city of Chicago. And in that report, it linked Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and Chicago. So it is by no mistake, and I am not exaggerating, when I say that the more than 100 black men who were tortured under Burge and his men, by Burge and his men, for more than 20 years, makes the city of Chicago the U.S. capital of torture. So it is very important that we continue to bring together and link the international issues of U.S. torture and the local and national issues of U.S. torture, because they are one and the same. They are fueled by the same inhumanity to fellow man, by racism. They exhibit the same tactics. They have the same cover-up. They have government officials covering it up and then wanting to call it by another name, wanting to justify it for one reason or another. But we cannot stand for that. We cannot stand for that, whether it's Richard Daley. We cannot stand for that, whether it's Richard Devine. And we cannot stand for that if it's President-elect Barack Obama. So we all must, here on the eve of his inauguration, have the will and have the vision and have the focus to join with all the rest of our comrades, not only in this city and not only in this country, but across the world, in calling for justice with regard to Bush, Cheney, and those who authorized and facilitated torture by the United States. If we don't do that, we ourselves are complicit in the torture, as well as they.
That was Flint Taylor from a presentation recorded on January 11, 2009. Next, we feature a brief interview with one of 10 protesters arrested at the offices of Illinois Senator Richard Durbin on the morning of Friday, January 16, 2009. 10 protesters face criminal trespassing charges after staging a sit-in protest at the office of Senator Durbin for his continued support of the Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip in December 2008 and January 2009. Maureen Murphy of the Palestine Solidarity Group was waiting for the Chicago police to be taken into custody and was interviewed over the phone by Chicago Indy Media's Rita Sand while Murphy was in detention in the Homeland Security Office at the Federal Building in Chicago.
Durbin accountable for what's happening in Gaza. Since 27 December, more than 1,100 Palestinians, the vast majority of them civilians, have been killed in a relentless bombardment by Israel from air, sea, and land. And these Palestinians are being killed with U.S. supplied and paid for weapons. And Senator Durbin so far has only expressed support for Israel's siege of the Gaza Strip. And so we came to his office because so far he hasn't been responding to the protests of thousands in Chicago to take a principled stand and meetings from other people in the community. And so we came today to demand that he make a public statement in support of the protection of Palestinian lives in the Gaza Strip and for an immediate ending of the Israeli siege on the Gaza Strip and for the lifting of the borders of the Gaza Strip so that urgently needed aid to help sustain the survival of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip can be entered. And we also called upon Senator Durbin today to initiate legislation to investigate whether or not Israel is in violation of the Arms Export Control Act of 1976, because so far it seems, and it should be emphasized that human rights observers and international journalists have been denied access to the Gaza Strip by Israel, and so no one's been able to do outside verification. But groups like Human Rights Watch, who are watching from the borders, are saying that it is more than likely that white phosphorus is being used as an anti-personnel munition against the civilian population in the Gaza Strip, in contravention to international humanitarian law. And so we wanted Senator Durbin to join the chorus of international organizations calling for an immediate embargo of arms to Israel while it is committing such war crimes in the Gaza Strip. So we came here today. There were about a dozen of us who came to the office to demand that we immediately speak to Durbin because the lives of Palestinians cannot wait long enough.
Okay, so you said about a dozen people.
Yeah, and 10 of us have been arrested.
Oh, 10 have been arrested?
Yeah.
So how many of you are there now?
10 of us are in detention right now.
Oh, you're in detention. I see. So you're not at Durbin's office anymore.
Right.
Okay. So is there anybody else left at Durbin's office?
Not from our group.
And why were you arrested? What did they tell you was the basis of your arrest?
They said that we were trespassing, even though we were here as citizens and Durbin's constituents want to hold him accountable, because so far we haven't been able to access him. And we refused to leave until we were given access to him.
I see. Did any of his representatives meet with you?
Yes. Four of us met with two of his community liaisons, and they promised to read what we had given them and to send us information about Durbin's positions. But we reminded them that it wasn't us who needed to be educated. It was Senator Durbin who needs to be educated about what is happening and his obligation. Humanitarian law, since the United States is a state party to the Fourth Geneva Convention and therefore obligated to uphold international humanitarian law and ensure the respect of international humanitarian all measures necessary to protect the lives of civilians under siege in the Gaza Strip.
I see. You cut out there for a couple seconds, two times,
okay.
But I don't know if that's because of where you are or what. Where are you exactly right now?
We're in the Department of Homeland Security office in the federal building.
In the federal building, I see. Did
yes.
they tell you what's going to happen to you?
They said that the Chicago Police Department is going to take us into detention.
I see.
And that we are being charged with criminal trespass.
I see. And what kind of warning did they give you before arresting you?
They did give us warning, and we told them that we couldn't leave in good conscience without having spoken to Senator Durbin and getting assurances from him that he would make an urgent intervention. And we were offered by his staff to come back at an appointment time, but we reminded the staff that we can't wait. The lives of Palestinians Gaza cannot wait. This is a matter of utmost urgency.
Mm-hmm. Are you all members of Voices for Creative Nonviolence?
No. There was a group of us representing either ourselves as individuals or groups like Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Myself, I'm with the Palestine Solidarity Group.
Okay.
But there were also groups that are listed on the press release.
Okay. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That was an interview with Maureen Murphy and Rita Sand, recorded on January 16, 2009. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Rita Sand for audio assistance. And special thanks go to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.